This week on Thinking Biblically, we're going to be looking at a key to being set free from the bitterness of the past. Welcome to Thinking Biblically. My name is Alan Gilman. Thinking Biblically is a podcast dedicated to exploring how all of Scripture speaks to all of life. Before we get into this episode's content, I want to remind everyone to please, if you haven't done so already, subscribe to my YouTube channel. Also, don't forget to like, share, and review as you are able. Well, last week, we looked at what I called God-mented reality. It's a bit of a play on words based on augmented reality, where through technology, we're able to introduce information that you can't normally see with our natural senses. And yet, there's a more exciting thing that we can have access to by the power of God's Ruach HaKodesh, His Holy Spirit, and I call it God-mented reality. And so you could check that out. You could look that if you haven't seen that already, but you don't have to see that before encountering what I'm going to share with you today. So when I do God-mented reality from augmented reality, in my mind, I'm quickly hearing God-mented reality. So there's God-mented reality and God-mented reality. To me, it sounds really different. I don't know what it sounds like to you. So God-mented reality is taken from the episode at the end of the book of Bereshit, Genesis, where Joseph is engaging his brothers after their father had died. And we'll get into more of the details of that interchange. But he says these most amazing words. I think they're some of the most amazing words in the entire Bible, where he says in Genesis chapter 50 and verse 20, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. What you meant for evil, God meant for good. And for Joseph to be able to be in that place where he's able to acknowledge the wrong that had been done to him, and yet to see the good hand of God working through it, and to be able to function well as a human being, I think is absolutely amazing and requires a certain kind of perspective that Joseph had and we can have if we pay attention to what God is seeking to teach us. And so what I'm going to do in this edition of Thinking Biblically is we're going to look at the story of Joseph. We're going to do a quick overview of key moments in his life from the book of Genesis to prepare us to grasp what really happens when he provides us with that amazing perspective near the end of the book, where he said, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. So let's get started with that. The story of Joseph is one of the longer stories of a character in the scriptures. It basically covers Genesis chapter 37 through chapter 50. I encourage you to read that if you haven't or haven't done so recently. And so it begins with his father, Jacob, showing favoritism towards him, as well as God's favoritism, in a sense, not favoritism as much as God's favor, I should say, God's favor towards him. Let's read here Genesis 37, verses 2 through 4. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was pasturing the flock with his brothers. He was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors. It might have been a robe with long sleeves. It's besides the point, I think. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peacefully to him. So to provide a little bit more background, as you might know but may not, Joseph was a son in a very complex, we could say messy, family. Jacob had run away from the the promised land where God had directed Abram, that his name was changed to Abraham, to go. Abraham and Sarah eventually had their son Isaac. Isaac was the father of twin boys, Esau and Jacob. Jacob had already been chosen by God to be the one to carry on the promises given to Abraham and then to Isaac. Don't have time to get into all of that detail, but there was quite a clash between Jacob and Esau, and Esau had vowed to kill Jacob. And so Jacob ran away to Mesopotamia, where his mom was from. And after arriving there, he fell in love with one of his cousins, Rachel, agreed with her father, his uncle, that he would work for his uncle Laban for 7 years, and then he would get Rachel to be his wife. And there's this wonderful, beautiful statement of how the 7 years were like a day or something like that, because of his love for her. You could just hear the romantic music playing. So the 7 years go by, the wedding happens, and he wakes up in the morning and he's with the wrong girl. Laban swapped out the older daughter, Leah, for Rachel. It must have been really dark, and maybe they had a bit to drink. Whatever it was, the girls were swapped out, and he ends up with the older daughter. Again, you could read all the other details for yourself. Jacob feels ripped off, and he makes another deal with Laban that he'll work another 7 years, but he gets Rachel right away. So now he has these two wives who are sisters, and Leah can have children and Rachel can't. And so Leah has kids, and then Rachel comes up with this idea of using surrogate motherhood and gives one of her maidservants to Jacob. He has children with her. And then Leah stops having kids and has children with her maidservant. And eventually, Rachel has a son on her own. Has a son, and that's Joseph. And it's possible that Jacob actually saw Joseph, the natural offspring of the beloved wife, Rachel. He probably saw him as the true firstborn, even though he was number 10 or 11. There'd be one more Benjamin, his younger brother through Rachel, would be born. There's also a girl in there. I don't know if the Bible tells us where she is in the birth order, as far as we know. So Jacob had with these four women 12 sons who became the tribes of Israel and at least one daughter, Jacob being the firstborn of Rachel, the beloved one. And so I know we read in the passage he was the son of his old age, but there is more. Certainly, there's more to this, and so he favored Joseph. Now, this sounds like a really messy family, and a type of messy family that I don't imagine most people listening or watching this are from that exact kind of. Well, there might actually be. There might be secrets that you've discovered in your family background, but even if you're from a more conventional family, and whatever conventional is today, families are messy, and many of our hurts that we grow up with in life come from our families of origin, and even among quote-unquote good families, the generally not chaotic households. I grew up in a very chaotic one, a very broken one, not as broken as some people. But my parents split up. I'm the youngest of four boys, much older than me. My parents split for a year when I was about eight, got back together, but still their relationship was not very good. And my father eventually left my mother and left me when I was about 15. And many of the things I struggle with come from what was happening in my household between my parents, my brothers and my parents, and my father, and many of you can relate. Some of you have never even talked about it, and you might be, and it took me years to realize, like, what kind of background my parents come from, and there's so many things that I don't know. The thing is, we live in a very broken world. The Bible talks about how sin has affected everything in the creation, and family, one of the most important parts of human life, family has been the source, as many of you know, of great, great hurt and confusion. And you can make your own list. Many of you know exactly what I'm talking about. And so my point is, even though your family may not look exactly like Joseph's family, he came from a messy, difficult situation with animosity, jealousy, hatred, and maybe you have too. And so there's something for you in this story. So let's stick with it and see where this goes, because we're going to see how Joseph found freedom in life, became an effective leader, a true follower of God, and even blessed his own family, even though they hurt him so badly. And so they were jealous of how his father was treating him. He tattletaled on them. I don't know what Joseph's motive was when the Bible speaks about him bringing a bad report. I read that to their father. Was it like a tattletale? We don't know all those details, but it seemed that he had this kind of maybe uppity attitude. He was younger than these brothers, and they resented him. And then he has these dreams. So not only did Jacob favor his son, God favored Joseph with these dreams. It took me years. I've loved this story for a long, long time. Thought about it a lot through the years. But it dawned on me much, much later that did he have to really tell his dreams? Did God say, tell these dreams to your brothers and they mean such and such? Maybe using in our kind of language today, he thought it was cool and he was maybe excited and he told them. But maybe, because they figured out pretty quickly that these dreams seemed to be saying that one day he would rule over his brothers. And we know that's what actually happens eventually. And they got the message, and his father confronts him on that. Like, why are you saying these things? And so on. And did Joseph not know what he was doing when he was telling these dreams to them? Is it possible he might have been a bit of a brat? I was the youngest in my family. I know that I was a brat. Not all the youngest are. Maybe you were. I don't know. But many families have their brats. And God wants to work in the life of the brat. And the favored ones, wrongly or rightly, and so on. And so anyway, they wanted to kill him. His brothers wanted to kill him. They hated him so badly. I'm not getting into all those details again. You can read it for yourself, like I said. But eventually end up selling him into slavery. Some might say death might have been better. But he gets sold into slavery. And then they lie to their father, saying that he was killed by a wild animal. So there's hatred. They sell him off. And then they lie to their father. And another detail took me many years to really notice this is how much they couldn't care less about what their father thought. Like, we know that Joseph was his favorite. And he made everyone know that Joseph was his favorite. And that was not the wisest thing to do. And it was one of the things that affected the situation. But the fact is, the brothers knew how much their dad loved Joseph, and yet they could care less about how their father felt in doing what they did and covering it up. Okay, so he gets so Joseph gets sold into slavery, and we read more than once. We read about how the Lord was with Joseph. We see this in Genesis 39, verse 2. We see his favor with his master Potiphar. Potiphar is the one who ended up buying Joseph from the slave traders. We read, the Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. Now, to be honest with you, this statement, the Lord was with Joseph, and we see that, the Lord promising to be with us, I'll be with you forever, statements in the Bible, I've struggled with that. I've struggled with that. What does that mean? Joseph was sold into slavery. We're going to see this again about the Lord being with him in prison. but things were not good. Things were not good for him. And I've struggled with, if the Lord's with me, why are my circumstances not better? Why doesn't the Lord get me out of this mess if he is with me? I don't think we should be expected to kind of like read the Lord is with us like some sort of Hallmark card and read it and go, oh, isn't it nice? The Lord is with us, without it really impacting us. Like, if we don't understand what that means, if we don't really connect with it, then they're just words. And I think the story of Joseph can help you and me to connect with the reality of God being with us, even when it's really, really rough. Now, one of the things that we do see is the Lord being with Joseph in Potiphar's house is that his master saw his ability. He gave him all this responsibility. But interestingly, the responsibility and his trust, Joseph's trustworthiness, was partly what ends up getting into the next stage of trouble, where he was allowed to be alone in the house. He was allowed to be alone with his master's wife, who had eyes for Joseph, tries to seduce Joseph. And the result of that is because he runs away from her. She ends up framing him, saying that he was trying to go after her, and he ends up in prison. A very interesting part of the story is how come he wasn't executed. I've often wondered if Potiphar understood more about his wife than we read about, that Joseph was only put in the dungeon. His life was preserved, but he was put in an Egyptian dungeon, which is not like, I haven't been in a modern prison. I've heard that North American modern prisons, well, they're certainly not as bad as what an Egyptian dungeon would have been. And we get hints in the story of Joseph of how lousy it really was and how much he didn't like being there. But his life was preserved. And then we read again in Genesis 39, verses 21 to 23, these words, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed." And so he's in the prison. I don't know if this is where Joseph learned his administrative skill, or he already had it and it comes to the fore because this is going to be used later on. Certainly, he's learning things that are not wasted in his life. But he's still in this prison, even though things are going as best as possible for him in that terrible place. Then as the story goes, there's two prisoners and they each have dreams. Joseph notices them, and he interprets their dreams. And there is a chief cupbearer and a chief baker, and I'm going to read his words to the cupbearer. So this is Genesis 40, verses 12 to 15. "Then Joseph said to him, the cupbearer," this is its interpretation to your dream, "the three branches are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you shall place Pharaoh's cup in his hand as formerly when you were his cupbearer. Only remember me when it's well with you, and please do me the kindness to mention me to Pharaoh so to get me out of this house. For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I have done nothing that they should put me into the pit." There were the two dreams, and the interpretation of the baker's dream was that he was going to end up being executed. And I just read the part to the cupbearer that he's going to be restored to his position. And this is exactly what does happen. But notice that knowing that the cupbearer would be restored, he's saying to the cupbearer, "Please put a good word in for me." And this is where we see, this is not a nice place. It's not like we can experience disappointment in life that sends us in a certain direction, and then we find ourselves surprisingly in a good place. Maybe we thought that good place would be a bad place. Maybe initially it is a bad place. It becomes a good place because of whether it's our attitude or things we realize. And eventually, Joseph will end up in a better place. still not, it's, it was still problematic to him as he rises to power in Egypt. But at this point, he's in a bad place and he knows that it's a bad place. And yet, he's able to see that God's with him and God uses him there. God is using him. God is favoring him. He has, he knows he has favor. He's risen to this role in the prison, but he doesn't want to be there. It's still a bad place. Also, it's not as if he's forgotten how he got there in the first point, in the first place. He mentions that he was stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and he was innocent. There was no reason why he should be there. So his brothers sold him into slavery. Bad. He was framed by Pharaoh's wife. Potiphar's wife. Bad. And he's recognizing bad, bad. Even though God is with him and God is using him. It's really important to understand how Joseph is able to acknowledge the bad. He's not simply covering up. He's not just putting on a good face, which a lot of us try to do. And we use the Lord is with us as another way to kind of cover the bad. He's calling the bad stuff bad. Please remember that. This is Alan Gilman. Do you like a good story? I sure do. But did you know that we're all part of the greatest story of all? God's story. The Bible is so much more than a collection of theological truths and fantastic tales. Even though it's written by 40 different authors over a span of about 1,500 years, it's a cohesive, compelling drama of epic proportions. And yet, we often read it in disjointed pieces in our attempt to mine it for little heartwarming nuggets to get us through the day. Well, but the Bible is so much more than that. It's one of my greatest passions to help people see the big picture of the Bible's overarching story. I'm convinced that the more we grasp the Bible's big picture, the better we will understand its details and discover our place in God's plan. So, I have developed the God's Epic Story Seminar to take you on a journey of key biblical passages in order to provide a clear outline of the Bible's big picture. By the time we're done, you'll be able to engage the Bible like never before. The next seminar will be on Friday evening, June the 13th, 2025, from 6:30 until 9, and continuing the next morning at 8:30 until 4 p.m. in Ottawa's West End at Chapel Ridge Free Methodist Church, 5660 Flew Ellen Road in Stittsville. Cost is free and includes lunch. A free will offering will be taken. Register now by scanning the QR code on your screen or at www.tinyurl.com/epicstory2025. That's www.tinyurl.com/epicstory2025. For more information, you can email epicstory@gmail.com. I hope to see you there, and please share this announcement with others. And so the cupbearer, as predicted, gets restored, but he doesn't remember Joseph. I wonder how that made Joseph feel, like, you know, oh, by now he should have said something. He's pointing at his watch. by now he should have said something. Oh, how come nothing's happening? And the days go by, and we don't have the full calendar reference. It might have been years. Nothing happened. Obviously, well, it didn't work. If the cupbearer said anything, didn't work. It turns out, according to the scripture, the cupbearer forgot him. Joseph had a terrible, hard, painful life. And then Pharaoh has these dreams, and nobody could interpret the dreams. And that's when the cupbearer goes, oh yeah, this happened when I was in prison. There's a guy there. I know a guy. I know a guy who can interpret your dreams. So they go get Joseph. They clean him up, and they bring him to Pharaoh. And he interprets Pharaoh's dreams about there'll be 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. And part of the whole interpretation that Pharaoh should prepare the country by collecting grain and putting it in storehouses for when the famine would come. It so impresses Pharaoh what Joseph said. He makes him second in command of Egypt. But I want to read Genesis 41, 50 to 52. We read here, before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph. Aseneth, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore them to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. The name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. Now, the names of these two boys could sound like, I'm better now, God causes all things to work together for good, foreshadowing what Paul would say later on in the book of Romans, like, you know, everything's fine now, it was hard, but okay. I'm not sure. I think that this idea of that God made me forget all my hardship is a way of saying that he's very aware of the hardship and he is acknowledging that God has done him good, but it's good in the midst of great difficulty. And that is emphasized in the name of the second son, because God made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. So here we have, yes, he's acknowledging good has come to him, but it's good in the midst of bad. It's comfort in the midst of suffering. They're together. It's not like, oh, well, that was then, this is now. It's not that kind of idea. He's still carrying the pain and feels the pain. He's still cut off from his dad and his brothers. His mom had died many years before. Okay, then the famine happens, and it's affecting the whole region, including the land that will be called the land of Israel, the promised land. And so Jacob sends his sons to go buy grain in Egypt. He hears the news that there's grain there, not knowing that his own son is in charge. And so they go, and they don't recognize Joseph. Joseph recognizes them. It's quite a story. And he starts doing this thing with his brothers, and we're never really told why, unless you let me know if it's very clear as to why. I think we can make some good guesses, but he's testing them in some way. I have a theory that he's testing them to see if their attitude toward their father changed. That's like a subtopic in the story. And I think something does happen to show him at least one of the sons has taken the relationship to their father seriously. He certainly wasn't waiting. I don't think. And there is a mention about them wondering. Eventually, they're wondering if the hardships they're experiencing under this Egyptian administrator is due to like getting payback for what they did to Joseph. But that's kind of so what? So they think they're being punished because they know it's obvious they did a bad thing. So my theory still stands that the real issue is Joseph's concern about the brother's relationship to the dad. So anyway, he does this testing of them. You can call it, he's playing with them, but not a very nice game. Accuses them of spies. Ends up taking their money, giving them grain, but they sneak the money back into the bags, and they keep he keeps one of the brothers, Simeon, in custody. So now they have to go back with another brother gone. Then they find the money in their sacks, and they're really freaked out by that. They don't know what's going on. They go back to their dad. He's upset. But when things continue to go bad and they need to buy more grain, they're telling their dad, we can't go because the fellow there in charge, not knowing that it was their brother Joseph, said they can't come back unless they bring the youngest brother, Joseph's only full brother, Benjamin, the other brother born to the beloved Rachel, with them. Jake said, why do you even tell him about Benjamin? Well, he was asking us all these questions, and they didn't know what was going to happen. But Joseph doesn't want to let the youngest son go, but eventually they're pleading with him because they're starving. And it's Judah who rises to the occasion and makes a pledge to his dad that he will ensure the safe return of Benjamin or else. Now, there's part of the story it's a little hard because he actually offers his own sons to his dad. And the point isn't so much what he was offering. It's the fact that he was showing that he was going to take responsibility for the youngest brother. And this is the beginning of the resolution of the story. So then they go back. Joseph sees the younger brother. It really hits him in the heart. He does some other things that kind of freaks them out of how he seats them down to eat, and he's continuing to play with them. He sets them up again as he sends them back, and basically he's going to be keeping Benjamin. And at that point is when Judah comes forward and offers himself as a slave to Joseph, and this and he expresses he cannot go back to their dad without the youngest son. And it's just a theory, because the text is not explicit. This seems to be what gets to Joseph and sees there has been a change here. At least the person who's acting like the firstborn in the family now, who's taking is doing what the oldest should be doing, and taking responsibility. That's when he breaks down. That's when he reconciles with his brother. We see that Genesis 45 verses 4 and 5. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near, and he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt." Notice he's mentioning what happened. "And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." So Joseph understands that the hand of God has been at work, while still mentioning that they did this wrong thing. And so they arrange for the whole clan to move down to Egypt, and Jacob, the dad, and Joseph, the son, are reunited. They settle in an area of Egypt called Goshen. Joseph uses his skill to help Egypt become a great power in that day, leveraging the fact that they had grain in the famine to assert their presence in that part of the world. The text goes on where his dad blesses Joseph's sons in chapter 48. I hope I'm saying all the names right, because I do tend to get mixed up. Then eventually we see in chapter 49, Jacob blesses his own sons, and then Jacob dies, and he's taken back in chapter 50 to the promised land for burial. And this sets us up for what happens in the last chapter of the first book of the Torah, Bereshit, the book of Genesis. So after Jacob dies, Joseph's brothers figure that their brother Joseph has only been nice to them because their dad was still alive. And they figured that once their dad died, Joseph was going to get him. And so they concoct this story. And this is what happens. It says here, Genesis 50 verses 15 through 17. "When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, 'It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him.' So they sent a message to Joseph saying, 'Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father.' Joseph wept when they spoke to him." They hadn't learned anything through Joseph's kindness. And they were transferring their way of thinking onto their brother. There's so much psychology in this whole story of Joseph and his family. But here they were. Joseph had gone through so much. He was so kind to them, but they didn't believe it was actually real. And that Joseph is going to do what most people would do when they go from being oppressed, especially oppressed by an identifiable group, and then they're in a position of power. And this is what we think people do and will always do. But Joseph was not like other people. And he was genuinely being kind to them. So here's what he says to them. And he wept because he saw, it broke his heart to hear them talk this way, to think that this is what he was like. So Genesis 50, verses 19 through 21. But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I'll provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." God meant it reality. Part of the brilliance of this statement is how Joseph was able to come to a place where he could recognize the hand of God to the extent that he could be kind and loving to the people who hurt him while not covering up that they hurt him and that what they did was wrong, what they did was bad, what they did was evil. That's exactly what he says. And he has no trouble saying it. "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." Both was true at the same time. Be careful with your philosophical-oriented minds of how we grapple with this. We can't really figure it out, but we can live this. We can be like Joseph. But in order to be like Joseph, we need to be able to call evil for what it is. He's not being asked, "Oh, you need to understand, they had such a hard childhood and all the wives and the competition and the dad and his twin brother wanting to kill him, and oh, it's terrible, how would you expect?" It wasn't that. It wasn't that sort of thing. It was like, "That's bad. What you did was bad, but God was working for good." Both were true. And he was able to function as a human being, as a son, as a brother, as a servant of Pharaoh, as an administrator in a difficult time. He's able to function out of his perspective of what God was doing, not as a reaction of all the bad that had done to him. He was free of any bitterness that would have controlled him, because he was able to put God first in this whole picture. But putting God first doesn't mean we don't call out what is wrong. And yet so many people, when they say, when somebody apologizes to them, if they get an apology at all, it's, "Oh, no problem. Oh, that's okay. That's okay." Is it okay? There are some things that people feel bad about that are no big deal. They don't really need to feel bad about what they did. Well, you could figure out examples yourself. Some things are no big deal. So we could say no big deal. If it's no big deal, if it's no problem, it didn't cause you a problem, say no problem. But did it cause you a problem? If it caused you a problem, don't say no problem. Don't say that's okay. Especially as believers, I guess all people, we're called upon to forgive. God wants to forgive us. We're told in the New Covenant writings in the New Testament, if we don't forgive others their sins, our Father in heaven will not forgive us. And forgiveness is this idea of loosing something and truly letting them go. But the letting go, it doesn't mean we cover it up. It doesn't mean that certain wrongs should not have consequences. When there's serious abuse, physical or otherwise, we need to deal with it, especially physical abuse. You might be in a situation where you are being abused by someone. You need to call the authorities. At some point, You need to personally forgive the person who's been hurting you. But forgiveness is not a way of saying it's no big deal. It's that you as an individual are not going to hold them in the chains of unforgiveness, but you're going to release them to God and release them, if necessary, to the authorities to deal with that person. But we don't stand over people as God or as a judge. That's God's job, the authorities' job, whoever those authorities might be, whatever kind of community we might be in, like the authorities in a school, the authorities in a family, the authorities in a society. But in terms of our own lives, if we, in order for we to be free of the bitterness that comes when we don't forgive, when we're not focused on the good that God's doing. Now, sometimes we don't know the good that God's doing. And I can't say that in every bad situation, God is doing good. In the long run, God does good in our lives. Not every situation is necessarily like Joseph's, where the brothers had a plan and God had a plan at that same time. And God was using the evil of the brothers to accomplish his good plan. Not every circumstance in life is like that. However, a lot of them are. Maybe I shouldn't say a lot of them are. They are whatever they are. I just know in my life, I've had times where I have looked back at all these various bad things that have happened to me. And sometimes it's obvious the good that God was doing, sometimes not so obvious. I remember some time ago, I was going through something and it led me to, or God led me to take some time to do this. Okay, let's go through these things that happened to me. And one of the things was when my father left when I was 15. And I only saw him for a brief time during that time period. And then I didn't see him for many years after that. And he was out of my life for the majority of my teenage years. I did not have my father, and he was alive, and he didn't reach out to me, and he wasn't involved in my life. And all the books tell me that not having a dad at that crucial point in my life, I could blame that for a lot of my problems. And you know, why God? Like, why did that? Why? And some people say, well, don't ask God why. He doesn't always tell why, but sometimes he does, and he's waiting for us to ask him. And so I'm not going to share the details of how God helped resolve this in my heart. But when I asked him, what's the good? What was the good of my father leaving? He showed me. And this is 30 years later. I'm carrying this wound of being forsaken by my dad, and my dad in heaven showed me the good he was doing through an otherwise terrible situation. And that's not the only thing in my own life. And so I encourage you, if you've never done this before, maybe you've had a wonderful life, you don't need to ask these questions, but if you have been either, like, you think you've been hard done by, like some of the things that have happened to us that we have bitterness about and unresolved wounds could be our perception of, purely our perception. It really wasn't what we thought it was. And it's possible humans will never be able to help us with that because they're not around. Or maybe they didn't understand what was going on. But God is able to clarify what really happened. That's the first thing. Maybe we're living with misunderstandings. And then if we really do understand that evil was done to us like it had been done to Joseph, if we ask God, he might just show us the good that he was doing through that otherwise terrible thing. There's one more thing. I think there's one more thing I want to share, and I alluded to earlier on how it took me a long time to realize that possibly Joseph was somewhat to blame, had some responsibility, some. What his brothers did was despicable and completely wrong, even though he might have been a brat. You know, but the thing with tattletaling is not a nice thing. But if they had done the wrong that he tattled about, It's not so much that he tattled, it's the fact that they were doing the wrong. And I won't get into a theology of tattletaling at this time. That's besides the point. The thing is, there was that, the way he handled his dreams and communicated to his brothers, he might have been a brat. We don't know what Joseph thought when he thought back to what had happened to him. But I do know what a lot of us do. Here we are, we're suffering the consequences of the wrongs of other people, and we wonder, what did we do? Now, there's a lot of people, even when they contributed to the thing, they just blame. And I'm not saying that blame isn't justified. Other people, even when they've been a true victim, spend almost all their time grieving, feeling guilty over their part, real or imagined. Now, let's talk about real. God, if it's imagined, may God help you with that. It's the same thing. Ask if you're still suffering over horrible events of the past. Ask God to show you really what went on, what's been going on, what he's been doing, and so on. And that applies to this too, our part. I have been told that one of the factors when people experience PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, when we've experienced a trauma, and that trauma overly affects us, cripples us emotionally in some way. It's common among soldiers coming back from battle. But it's also when we experience various kinds of abuse from others, and other kinds of trauma that could affect us. We may not have been soldiers. Maybe we've been in war-torn countries or in other very difficult situations. We've seen trauma. It could really affect us. But I've been told that when it overly affects us in the form of PTSD, it's common that it's not so much the trauma that we've endured, the trauma that we've witnessed, but when we have been the proponents of the traumatic event. So for many soldiers who were called to do horrible things on the battlefield, it's the killing of other people, for example, that often is the source of the PTSD. I don't want to overly simplify it. My point is that very often our inability to find freedom from the traumatic events of the past, whatever they might be, is sometimes not so much about what they did to us, but it's what we did. And the inability to find freedom for ourselves. And yet it seemed Joseph wasn't controlled by what he might have done. And that he became a person that here's the guy with dreams, and maybe he abused the way he told his dreams to his brothers. He rose up to the occasion and he interpreted the dreams. He didn't go, oh boy, the last time I did this, it was a disaster, and I was the object of the disaster. He didn't do that. He asserted himself and interpreted the dreams and did it again with Pharaoh. He was a smart guy. He was a blessed guy. He was a favored guy. And the fact that he was favored, in a sense, is what got him to trouble in the first place. So he didn't hide himself under a rock. And I think there's many people who might listen to a message like this, that you are hiding under a rock, not because of the bad things that happened to you necessarily, but the part that you think you played in what resulted in your own suffering. When people talk about the need to forgive yourself. And I think it was one of my sons. Maybe I should have asked him first so I could properly credit him. But I'm pretty sure. Who said, no, that's not right. Especially for those of us who are believers in the Messiah, our problem with not letting ourselves off the hook for our wrongs is we don't really believe that God has forgiven us. We're denying. When we keep ourselves in a prison of not accepting God's forgiveness, we're basically calling God a liar. And it's putting us out of sorts with God. When we put ourselves out of sorts with God, we're putting ourselves out of sorts with the whole universe. We are out of whack. I don't know what the opposite of out of whack is. Write in the comments. But the way to be properly in line with the lives that God has for us is we need to accept God's forgiveness. And somehow, Joseph was able to live his life free. And I believe, even though it's not fully explained, it's because he really knew God. In the midst of everything he was going through, he knew God. He trusted God. He lived out of his relationship with God. And this is what we see when he said to his brothers, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." And then look what he ended up doing. And we're going to close with this. Here he was in a foreign land, a land that worshipped all these other gods, not the true God. And he was able to do good unto that society and the whole surrounding region, including his own family. God used him to save the people of Israel in a foreign land with whole other sets of values and understanding of life and truth. And he was able to serve God there, be a blessing to his own people and to other people, and be a key character in the working out of God's restoration plan for the creation, preparing the word for the coming of the Messiah and all that we're called in to do and the mission of the Messiah that's been given to us. He played such a key role, but he did so in a very difficult place. Here in Canada, we just had an election and about half of the people aren't happy with the results. So what? In one sense. So I'm not saying we shouldn't care about the political thing. I care very much, and I think we should care about it. And we should get involved as much as God calls us into doing it. But if the society isn't going the way that we think, it's you know, according to the Bible, if the society isn't going in the way that we think it should, join the club. Yeshua himself entered into an evil world. Going back, Abraham was called to go into a foreign land. Joseph was taken into a foreign land and serve the purposes of God there. It wasn't so great when he was with his own family. It wasn't great when he ended up in Egypt. Eventually, God used him big time. And God wants to use you and me big time. But in order to do that, we need not to be controlled by the evil. We need to be freed from it. And the only way to be free from that evil is to be like Joseph and to be able to say to all the evil around, "You mean it for evil, but God means it for good. And God is at work." But in order for us to be walking with God, we cannot allow ourselves to be overcome by all the evil around us. I know how easy it is for the evil to overtake us and for us to be consumed by it, but we don't have to stay there. We can be like Joseph. Well, I hope that was helpful. If it was helpful to you, please share it with others. You know, even if you just liked what I had to say, please give it a thumbs up on whatever podcast platform you're listening to, however you can respond with a positive. I'd love to see that. I got one of my first real harsh anti-Semitic comments. Like, there's a lot of people that are getting that sort of thing, but I just got one on another podcast episode. So what? I think they're wrong. But it does help to get the positives. Very often I know that, you know, if we don't have something good to say, we don't say it. We only share the negatives. So I appreciate it. If you appreciated this, that you would say so, at least with a thumbs up. But even a comment is even better. If this is speaking to you in any particular way and you find it helpful, please let me know. If it's too personal to share publicly, you can send me an email at comments@thinkingbiblically.org. You can send questions there too, the ones that you feel are a little more private. But if it could be public, please put it in the comments section. Also, share it with others. And if you haven't subscribed, please do that. I really would appreciate that. And also, if you are in the Ottawa area, as you might know already, next month I'm going to be doing my God's Epic Story seminar at Chapel Ridge Church in the Stittsville, Kanata area. I would love to see you there. And if you're not in this area and you want me to come out and do the seminar where you live, please let me know and we can see if we can work something out. But if you are here, it'd be great. It's free. There's going to be lunch provided. And it's all part of this God-mented reality, because if we don't understand the big picture of God's story that he's called us to be part of, we're not going to be able to navigate life in the way that we should. And so that's what I try to do through the seminar. And if you have any questions about that, again, comments@thinkingbiblically.org or put it in the comment section below. I think that's it. And so until next time, this is Alan Gilman with Thinking Biblically.